Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I thank you very much for coming. I am particularly pleased to see a few of my Norwegian friends in the audience. What I'm going to tell you, it won't be an academic lecture, just a little bit about autobiography as a literary genre and about my experience of writing autobiography. I developed a keen interest in autobiography while working in the library as a librarian and later selling second-hand books in a charity shop, both in England. I noticed that biography and autobiography were in the great demands by the public. Very often they looked for books of this kind more keenly than for fiction. Then when I wrote my two books and received lots and lots of response of letters from unknown readers, I decided to do some research on this subject. And now I want to share with you what I learned and also tell you about how I have written my first book. First of all, a definition. What is autobiography? It is a form of literary expression in which the author tries to recreate his or her life using all the available resources of memory and research. Unlike diaries or journals written spontaneously from day to day, autobiography or memoirs look back at the story from a long distance of time and usually are written late in age. The first work of the kind I heard about, anyway, it comes from 5th century, and these are Confessions of St. Augustine. Strangely enough, this book is still readable. I can't boast I've read the book, but I had a good look at it, and it's very readable. Then comes a long time, the autobiography as a literary kind, in fact, begins 10 centuries later, with the Renaissance. At this stage, it mainly deals with the subject of religious faith. Strangely enough, the first work of this kind comes not from Italy nor France, but from England. A certain Marjorie Kempe from Norfolk, at her deathbed, dictated a candid account of her sins and faith. She did it in a series of episodes developed by dialogue and showed an utter humility, referring to herself as a creature. The Age of Enlightenment brings a few autobiographies of greater significance and wider outlook. They are written by prominent authors, such as, for example, the great English historian of the 18th century, Edward Gibbon, better known for his history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, famous for his Confession, like Benjamin Franklin in America. Their works reflect not only the strong personalities of the authors, but also the spirit of their times. The first poetical autobiographies come with the Romantic movement. In England, it's Wordsworth's Prelude and Byron's Childe Harold, partly. 19th century sees an outburst of keen interest in self, in the development of personality, with Goethe's Aus meinem Leben, a self-searching kind of writing, begins to flourish everywhere in Europe and in America. Throughout the 19th century and up to the present time, people of greater and smaller merits, of various backgrounds and for all kinds of reasons, write down their life stories. To remind you of only few, I'll mention at random Charles Darwin's autobiography, Kipling's Something of My Life, Winston Churchill's My Early Life, and so on. As modern works of particular weight, I would mention Marcel Proust's A la recherche du temps perdu, which, in the guise of a novel, explores his own life, and Jean-Paul Sartre, Les mots, the words, that tells about his childhood as the formative years of a future thinker and writer. Our postmodern era sees an avalanche of autobiographical books written by pop stars, sports champions, by the victims of some disasters, of kidnapping, hijacking, memoirs of deserted wives who take revenge on their unfaithful husbands, a great deal of these books are written with the help of ghostwriters and with money in mind. Why people write autobiography? There are very many kinds of autobiographies and very many different reasons for which they are written. Each autobiographer writes because he or she has a story to tell. Like a novelist, an autobiographer is first of all a storyteller. According to Walter Benjamin, or if you prefer, Walter Benjamin, storytelling basically falls into two categories. Benjamin dubbed them sailor's tales and farmer's tales. Sailor tells us about unusual, farmer about usual. From a sailor, we learn about faraway lands and strange happenings we are unlikely to see or experience ourselves. The farmer speaks about daily life, that although different is still comparable to our own. I'd say that autobiographies written by people of particular achievements and fame, unless they tell only about their childhood, fall in the category of sailor's tales because it's exotic for us, ordinary people. Great scholars, artists, writers, statesmen, late in their lives, often feel need to write about the circumstances and the processes that led to their achievements. Others, both sailors and farmers, try to explain, not only to the readers, but also to themselves, how their beliefs were formed, or to give testimony to the outside world and to the events of public and historical importance which they saw, either being actively involved or only as eyewitnesses. But often, the motivation for writing an autobiography is a search for self-knowledge, a need to create a self that otherwise does not exist, to give a meaning to one's own life. American novelist Philip Roth claims that, I quote, over 50 you need ways of making yourself visible to yourself. And Jean-Paul Sartre, each wishes to write because each needs to be significant, to signify what he experiences. Otherwise, everything goes too quickly. One has one's nose to the ground like a pig that is forced to dig up truffles. Writing about himself as a small boy, Henry James discovered the child's identity and thus found what he had lacked before. I quote, something to distinguish me by. Very often, digging in one's own childhood serves as a therapy, as Freudian psychoanalytical treatment. Why did I write in my books? I am not a personality with great achievements, just an ordinary person who once used to be an ordinary teenage girl trapped in the walls of the Warsaw Ghetto and later grew into an ordinary woman coping with 3 children, with work, with studies, under the circumstances of the communist regime in Poland. I think I should rather call myself a creature. Was it arrogance then, not only to write about my life, but also to send it to a publisher? Honestly, I don't think so, because I never wanted to make a hero of myself or to show to the readers something to distinguish me by. My only aim was to serve as an eyewitness, herself deeply involved in striking historical processes of our times. It was history, I believe, that made my life significant and worth writing about and perhaps reading about. Now I'll tell you a little bit about my first book, Winter in the Morning. Winter in the Morning is a simple account of my childhood as a daughter of a prosperous Jewish doctor, assimilated Jewish doctor, in pre-war Warsaw, and my adolescence that began and ended together with the Second World War and the Nazi occupation of Poland. If I am to speak about this book, I want to tell you a little about its contents, which means about my life. I was 13 when the war began, and 14 when my mother, with my mother and younger sister, was forced to leave our comfortable home in the so-called Aryan part of Warsaw and move into the ghetto. The Warsaw Ghetto was surrounded with high walls, topped with barbed wire. The gates were heavily guarded by German soldiers and Polish and Jewish police. It was death penalty for a Jew who would try to sneak out of the ghetto, and a very severe punishment awaited a Pole who would enter the ghetto without a special permit. At the beginning, 300,000 people, one-third of the Warsaw population at the time, was crammed onto this relatively small space inside the walls. But very soon, people, Jews from little towns and villages surrounding Warsaw were herded into the ghetto too, and its population rapidly grew to 500,000. There were thousands and thousands of families robbed of all their belongings, reduced to poverty and with nowhere to live. They lived in the streets, begging for food, and died on the pavements from starvation and infectious diseases such as typhus. On the other hand, there were people, many people, who could still survive and still lead a more or less normal life because they had some money or valuable things they could sell and buy food at the black market, that against all odds still thrived in the ghetto. The gap, the divide between the haves and have-nots was appalling. It was a gap between life and death, those living and those dying, literally rubbed shoulders in the overcrowded streets. I belong to those more fortunate. I had a roof over my head, a very small one, but still a roof. I didn't starve. I had a breakfast and a dinner and a lunch, whatever. And I resumed my education in the ghetto, attending some small groups who met with a teacher in a private house. I also worked in a cemetery, growing vegetables for the poor. It calmed my conscience a little bit. On my way to the classes or to work or back, I walked along streets strewn with dying people and with corpses laying on the pavements, covered with papers, newspapers, and pressed down with bricks. It was very hard at the beginning to put up with it. I really couldn't look at those people, but couldn't sleep at night. But after a time, little by little, I got used and stopped paying much attention to the dying beggars. Because there is only a certain amount of suffering you can get in and still retain the ability of feel pity. Beyond this point, you become deaf and blind and still and you still live. During the 21st, altogether I spent in the ghetto 26 months. What I was telling now applied to the first 20 months. During these first 20 months, when I studied and grew cabbage and beetroots and listened to music and experienced my first love, 100,000 people died in the ghetto from starvation, diseases, random shooting in the streets, and from suicides. The worst was still to come. In 1942, Hitler decided upon the final solution of the Jewish question, of the Jewish question, which meant physical annihilation of all Jews in all countries of the occupied, Nazi-occupied Europe. the so-called action of deportation to the labor camps began in Warsaw on 22nd July 1942. 5 up to 13,000 people were daily heard to the trains and brought not to the labor camps but straight to the gas chambers of Treblinka. From the very first moment, my family, which means my mother, sister, my uncle, and we were six in the small flat, from the very first day we decided we won't obey, we won't go out when ordered, but stay in the flat or hide, because we knew that we shall be shot dead if they find us. But this seemed better than a prolonged process of dying, which we expected in the labor camps, the humiliation of this dying. For 6 months, the three of us, my mother and my sister and myself, ran away from one hiding place to other because the ghetto shrank from day to day. And there was less and less opportunity to hide. For days and weeks, we stayed in some awful places, in dark cellars, in stuffy lofts, in holes in the walls, concealed behind some heavy pieces of furniture, in the ruins, under the rubble, with no light, no food, and not enough air to breathe properly. We were extremely lucky. We were never discovered in these hideouts, although death was always next door. In January 1943, when the ghetto shrunk to several blocks only, and there was no longer hope we could survive there, the three of us ran away from the ghetto to the other side of the walls. Since then, we embarked upon a two-year period of hiding among Christian population of Warsaw and other places. There was death penalty for Jews found at the Aryan side, and for the Poles who sheltered or otherwise helped the Jews. High award was promised to everyone who would denounce a hiding Jew to the Gestapo. And yet we had friends and we found somewhere to stay. It was a Polish family, a professional Polish family, who took us under their roof. There we stayed, locked in a small room, never going out, never coming near the window, trying to be invisible and inaudible to the strangers. And yet, after 3 months, we were discovered, I don't know how, by some blackmailers, and we had to run away. Since then, for the following 70 months or even longer, for the following 21 months, we went on the run, coming across all kinds of people who risked their own life and the lives of their families, including young babies, to shelter us. For this or that reason, the reasons were various. There were professional families, as I said, and working class families. Quite a lot of members of the Polish resistance, underground resistance. There was a drug addict who needed money to buy her drugs. And an occultist who was not afraid to have us because she believed in providence. there was a friendly prostitute who night after night entertained Nazi officers when we were dying from fear in the next room. Then there was a young priest and his octogenarian mother in a village near Kraków who not only sheltered us but also fed us without any award. Deeply religious people. Time and again we were discovered and blackmailed or threatened to be announced to the Gestapo. We were reduced to tatters. We had no more money, nothing. We came across the utter cruelty and corruption, more corruption than cruelty. But also, we met on our way people of great integrity and courage. Eventually, we survived the war. In the ghetto, from time to time, I kept a diary, not regularly. And later in hiding, when there was a little more time, it lasted a few weeks or so, I wrote short stories, which helped me to survive the boredom of it. Stories about what I had heard and seen in the ghetto. These manuscripts miraculously survived the war. After the war, I never tried to publish them or write a memoir. These papers just stayed in a drawer in Warsaw, in my flat in Warsaw. For 40 years, I kept silent about my past and never told my family the full story of my survival. I was not the only one like that. Lots of people with a similar or much worse experience. For years, kept silence, or even till the end of their lives, never said a word. Saul Friedlander, a historian of the Holocaust, says that the repression of memory is the characteristic response of the Jewish survivors to their frightening past. In his autobiography, entitled When Memory Comes, he writes, "We Jews," I quote, "we Jews erect walls around our most harrowing memories. Even a story complete to the last detail sometimes turns into an exercise in hiding things from ourselves. These necessary defenses are one of the chief features of our most profound dread." Many authors point to a particular event that instantly carried them back into the past and thus induced to write. For Marcel Proust, as it seems, it was the taste of a biscuit soaked in tea. For Chateaubriand, it was listening to a bird singing on a tree. For me, it was something less trivial. For me, it was the death of my mother and sudden realization that I was the only one who could tell our story because my sister had died a long time before. Throughout those all long years, I felt that it's my duty to leave a testimony, if not to the world at large, at least to my children and grandchildren. I also felt obliged to say something about these brave Polish people who helped. When we left Poland in 1968, for the first time, I realized how awful opinion the Poles have in the West. They were considered staunch anti-Semites who were worse than Germans during the war. They had it in their blood and so on. Probably this opinion was unfortunately based in real facts, but certainly it was only one side of the coin. I knew something else, and I felt obliged to tell it in public. And so I started writing Winter in the Morning. It's amazing how memory works. Once I decided to recall my past, the memories began to flow in powerful waves. It was like a flood. Some long forgotten events and places and faces of people I had known then. Smells and tunes, my own thoughts and feelings at the time were coming back to me. But could I write it down bit by bit as it was coming? Of course I couldn't. Unlike a diary or a journal, to make sense and be readable, a memoir or autobiography must have a story structure. It has to read like a novel. There is no point in overloading it with details that you manage to remember in abundance if they don't help to convey a message, to describe the characters involved, to render the atmosphere or build up dramatic tension. The author must first decide what is the purpose of his or her writing, what he or she wants to tell the readers, and then act like a sculptor. Carve her memories, chop off all that is meaningless, redundant, what does not contribute to the story in any respect. In other words, to write an autobiography is to discover, even to create, a meaningful pattern in one's own past. It needs selecting the memories according to this pattern. Selecting is the first task, but it is not all. The memories come in bits and pieces. Bits and pieces don't make a narrative. In order to build the narrative, the author has to fill the blanks, link the single bits with each other in a smooth and plausible way. Here comes imagination, helped by a sense of probability. It could have been so. Probably it was so. No autobiography can be written without such a touch of fiction. Shaping the narrative in Winter in the Morning was for me relatively easy. From the very beginning, I decided on what I was going to write, what would be the main subject of this book. First and foremost, I wanted to show the moral attitudes of the people I had come across during the war, and also my own moral attitudes. Secondly, I believed it would be interesting to show the process of my coming of age in these unique conditions of the Holocaust. So I stuck to these two subjects, getting rid of all memories that did not contribute and linking those which did by resorting to learned guesses, to imagination rooted in my past experience. It could have been so and so. Now, you can ask me, how true is this story? My answer is, It is a true story of a young girl as she experienced it, and as I, the author, remember it. It is not a historical document. It is this girl's truth and mine. If another eyewitness of the same events writes quite a different story, it may be true as well. It will be his truth. To give you an example, when my book was first published in Poland, I received a letter from an unknown man who said that he was almost my neighbor, lived at the same street, very near, and went through all this like myself. But he said, why did you omit this and this? Why did you distort some other things? He sent me a list of omissions and distortions. I was appalled. Before I came to the end of the letter, where he said that he was 12 years my senior. It's pretty obvious that a man of 27 sees the world differently than the schoolgirl of 15. One can't write about facts without one's own interpretation. Goethe said, I quote, "Truth belongs to all written accounts of one's life, either in relation to matters of fact or in relation to the feeling of the autobiographer, and God willing, in relation to both." Writing Winter in the Morning took me almost 2 years. During that time, I tried hard to forget all my subsequent knowledge about the war and the Holocaust, and I tried hard to black out my present mature reflection. I dived so deep into my past that for the time of writing, I turned, as it were, into this young girl that used to be myself. I chose a very simple language, like she would have used. I didn't want to make her better or wiser than she had really been. And yet, the truth in our autobiography is elusive. Memory itself performs the first sifting process and often rejects some important facts. Then the authors, trying to give a proper shape to their accounts, make their own selection and reject all that seems to be of little importance. But sometimes, unconsciously, they may also reject memories they are reluctant to confess. Writing Winter in the Morning, I made a strong, conscious effort to hide nothing which I would have preferred to hide. And so I said many bitter things about the behavior of some Jews in the ghetto, of some Poles, about my relatives and friends, but first of all about myself. But I still can't be sure if I've managed to say all. Some important things could still escape my memory, repressed into subconsciousness. In his last book, The Drowned and the Saved, Primo Levi says, I quote, "Many survivors of wars or other complex and traumatic experiences tend unconsciously to filter their memory. Summoning their memories, they prefer to dwell on moments of respite, on grotesque, strange or relaxed intermezzos, and to skim over the most painful episodes which are not called up willingly from the reservoir of memory and therefore with time tend to lose their counters." This could have happened to me too. In this study, Design and Truth in Autobiography, Roy Pascal, an American author, claims that no autobiography, no matter how honest, can be free of omissions and distortions. And that is why readers take autobiography not as factual truth, but as resting, fighting with truth. I believe that fighting with truth, I have done all I could to give an honest, if not full, account of my childhood and adolescence. Thank you.
Some questions?
Yes, I thought it was too late for questions. Of course, if there are. Okay. Of course, I thought it was too late. Of course, there are.
It is a little bit difficult.
Am I still connected?
Yes. We will disconnect you.
Yes, please. I'm going home tomorrow.
Yes. It's very difficult to say something, and I think that we should open up the floor for some questions. The only thing I would like for myself to say that I'm very glad you did not keep silent anymore.
I'm glad too, you know, it helps a lot.
Yep.
I become someone quite different since I've written this book.
We have some minutes for questions. You can either, preferably ask them in English or in Norwegian, then we will translate. Asbjørn will have the microphone. Okay, some comments or to Janina's talk? Okay, you don't feel.
It may be a simple question, but what was the most difficult work in this memory work that you did? What was the most difficult challenges in remembering?
In this book, chapter 4.
which was
about the selection. After this first action, so-called, when most of the people were deported and only some left, it came a moment then we were pretty sure that this is the end. We were called, the remaining people were heard it all together at the square, and we knew about it in a bit of advance, and we were trying to get rid of everything we still had. And this was somehow, it looked like saying goodbye to life. And when I was writing this part of the book, I got so tremendously upset that people, friends, acquaintances, didn't know what happened. Are you ill or what? It was the worst part of writing, really. Others, it was really, the writing was somehow easy. It's hard to say. It's a strange thing to say. The second book, which deals with my post-war life, was far, far more difficult to write than the first one. With the first one, it was as if someone stood behind me and dictated what I should write. It was like if my late mother and sister were with me and dictated me what to write. Just it came spontaneously, not the second book. I am not sure if I answered your question before.
another question before we leave for a break? Take a break? Okay, then we will just thank you for coming here.
Thank you very much for having me. Okay.